We can talk about concussions in high school sports today, and our guest is Dr. Tom Trojan, Director of the Injury Prevention and Sports Outreach Programs at the New England Musculoskeletal Institute at the UConn Health Center. This is something that's come to the forefront a couple of years ago. Laws have been passed about it, and that's why we want to bring Tom in to talk about this. Tom, good morning. Thanks for coming in today, and tell us what this law that came into effect on July 1st, 2010 is all about.
So PA 1062, good morning, Wayne. Thanks for having me on. PA 1062 is a law concerning the students in the high school and athletics, and it's to prevent concussion injuries from getting worse. When a high school athlete plays a sport and gets signs and symptoms of a concussion, they're to be removed from play. That wasn't necessary prior to the law. It's now becoming more and more commonplace in each state in the union that now have these laws. We were the third proposed at the time. And it also involves, in our state, coaching education. So coaches in our state have to get educated on different aspects, and they get to choose a lot of them. One of the mandatory ones now is concussions, since concussions is a big problem in the state.
Does this pertain only to high schools? What about elementary, middle school? Because sometimes those students have games as well.
Yeah, that would be wonderful if we could move it down in that direction. They don't have mandatory education for those coaches, and then it became a cost. And one of the things is to educate the youth and to move it towards youth coaching. We did a survey that was published in Connecticut Medicine, and that survey asked the coaches after this law, would they believe that it would be beneficial to move it to youth sports? And over 80% felt that it would be helpful to move it to youth sports. So I think the movement's there. We just have to get over the expense. And with our current economy, nobody wants to add new expenses to the bills.
And I'm wondering what the overall reaction has been. The law has been in effect now for about 2.5 years or so. The reaction of the parents, I think they'd be happy because they're sons and daughters are hopefully going to be healthier, and also the reaction of the coaches and also the administrators from the school.
Yeah, we did, during that survey, we asked the coaches, because the big concern was when you talk to coaches and you're going to add a new responsibility to them, how much of a problem is this going to be? Is it going to be a problem for them? So we asked coaches that question in our survey, and they felt that this law was actually beneficial for them. I think it makes their job easier. You don't need to make a decision, should this kid be in or out when they have a head injury. They get a head injury, they start getting some of the signs or symptoms of it, a headache, dizziness, feeling nauseous, light, you know, problems with light or noise, and they just pull them out. And that way they prevent this from getting worse. Because the big problem is this thing that David Wong over at Children's calls overlapping concussion syndrome. And what that is when a person gets a concussion and then they go back and play and get a concussion again, that's a big problem, because those kids have much longer, much, much longer symptoms, much, much longer problems than the kid who has a concussion and then allows their brain to heal.
And isn't it a bigger deal for kids at that age, we're talking high school age here, as opposed to say that someone's 35 or someone that's our age, because the brain is still developing?
Yeah, it's not the same brain as somebody who's 25 or 28, et cetera. And you're right, it's still developing, it's still growing, and it still grows well past the 18 years of age. And it's the last part of the body to really mature. And it's very important for us to keep that in mind when we have a head injury, that we don't want them to go back. We don't want to push them. I know that parents are very concerned about getting the kids back to sports. The kids are really excited about getting back to athletics. But it's one of those things where that you only have one brain. It's not like you have two ankles or two knees.
So if they were allowed to keep playing, and either playing with a concussion or aggravating that concussion, what's the worst-case scenario?
Sure. So the worst-case scenario is something that they call second impact syndrome, and that's debatable. It exists, but people do die who have head injuries and get hit again. Sadly, you know, that also sets them up for more likely to get subdural hematomas and other problems like that, which are, that's a fancy word for bleeding in the brain. And they get these bleeding in the brain, and that becomes a problem. They could die. But the big problem, the big overwhelming problem, is prolonged symptoms, missing school. You know, you see these children who have multiple concussions without coming out of the game, who have symptoms 6 months, a year, and from there on, where they're having trouble attending classes, the trouble going to school. And that's not what athletics is supposed to be.
Let me ask you about the sports where concussions are most likely to happen. Now, I read a story indicating, of course, that helmet-on-helmet or helmet-on-knees injuries with football probably is the biggest. But national statistics indicate that both girls' soccer and girls' basketball have high percentages of concussions followed by boys' soccer and boys' basketball. Is that what you've seen, too?
Yeah, definitely. The fall is a big time for concussions, with soccer and football being played. You know, most of the concussions that occur in soccer occur due to fouls, not necessarily heading the ball, but most of the injuries are because of elbows to the head. So as people go up for a head ball and the defender goes up with their elbow and hits the person in the head, those are the big problems that occur. And there was recent research done that showed that 60% of these head injuries occur due to fouls.
Is a concussion always seen at the moment of impact? By that I mean during the game. Or are there occasions where it could happen and the symptoms don't show themselves for hours or maybe days later?
Yeah, most often they happen right away, but they can be delayed, usually to the end of the game where it kind of builds. People can get hit in the head, they get a little jarred, they usually have something minor, and then they feel like they shake it off. Then once they shake it off, as, so to speak, then it kind of builds from there. And then they keep doing their activity after the end of the game, they start feeling lightheaded, nauseous. It's not uncommon for you to have, like in hockey, where somebody gets hit, they'll come off, and then the next shift they'll start having problems when they start to skate again.
Well, if it's not always seen immediately, doesn't that make a gray area when it comes to the coaches diagnosing if their player has a concussion?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, one of the big problems is the coaches being able to be attentive, and that's why it's important to have the assistant coaches and all coaches, not just head coaches, part of the education, which is what we have. You know, when you have one of your position coaches notice that the kid isn't acting right, that's very helpful for things. It's not often that that occurs. It does occur, but it's not often. The more overwhelming is the person gets hit, they get symptoms.
When a student athlete gets a concussion, what then does the medical community do to try to alleviate or eliminate that concussion? Is there any kind of a rehab they can do?
Yeah, most of the things that we do is rest, actually, and put the brain at rest. They do something that has been coined cocoon therapy, which, you know, we don't want to isolate the kid too much, but it is stop texting, stop all the electronic media that we have in mm-hmm. front of us, because that eye contact and having to read and track with the eyes does play a lot of trouble with a person with concussion. And then as well, not listening to loud music, letting the brain heal up and rest up. There's some new research on adding things like fish oil and other omega-3 fatty acids to try to reduce the inflammation in the brain. Still unproven, but those are the directions. There's always a new treatment that's been tried. There's been calcium channel blockers and other medications, but none of them seem to have been a guarantee yet. So the tried and true is rest
now,
at first.
Who makes the decision that that student athlete is now clear to come back and play? It's not going to be the coach.
No, the way the rule is written is that a certified athletic trainer, a nurse practitioner, a PA, or a physician makes that documentation, that ruling, and it's a written return to play. The nurse practitioner, the PA, and the athletic trainer all work under the direction of a physician, and so having people who work under somebody who's been trained in concussions. And then it's up to the physician to make sure that they feel comfortable in managing concussions.
Which brings up another topic altogether, that some school districts, including a few around here, as a budget-cutting move, have decided to eliminate or reduce the role of athletic trainers when it comes to interscholastic sports. And I'm guessing you don't approve of that.
I don't, for this reason. I mean, when you have a school nurse, and the school nurse is there during the day. And if you had your school cut away their school nurse to help your children, you'd be upset. If you knew that only 60% of your schools had school nurses, that would be a problem. And only 60% of our high schools with high school athletics, with athletic competition, do not have somebody like a certified athletic trainer in the state of Connecticut to help protect our children. And I think they're important. They're vitally important, not only in the college, but also in the high school athletics.
Sometimes a player takes a hit. Let's say the quarterback gets sacked. Let's say a foul, as you said, in soccer. And it's pretty obvious that maybe there's some trauma to the head involved. But there might be something away from the ball, something that nobody saw. At that point in time, how do you know that particular student-athlete might be in jeopardy?
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where you have somebody who isn't coaching, isn't trying to watch the ball. You have a certified athletic trainer on the sidelines, and their job is to pay attention to what's going on around the field. They are not just watching the play, they're watching what happens. You know, as a sideline physician for numerous years, you can watch and see and know prior to the person coming off almost always what's going on because you're watching and seeing the injury occur.
Broadcasting sports as I do, I've seen a number of cases where student athletes are diagnosed with concussions. And one of the things you always know when they are testing for concussion is the index finger going side to side in front of the player's eyes. What are you looking for there?
Sure. So going back a step, when you're looking at the brain works in multiple ways. So you have different sections of the brain. What you're doing there is eye tracking. So one of the problems that can occur is eye tracking, and you're looking for something called nystagmus, or the eye flutters as it moves across. Normally, as you were doing it here in the studio, as people can't, doesn't work well on radio, is that you could see your eyes move nice and smooth. And when you do this on somebody who has a concussion, what you can often see is the eye actually flutters. It bounces. And that's an eye-tracking problem, or that part of the brain is injured. You have to look for the different parts of the brain that gets injured, and each part can be different.
And is that something they do later on, like a day or a week later, to confirm the fact that either the player still has a concussion or it's getting better?
Yeah, one of the things that seem to come back the slowest is actually your ability to bring your eyes together, or that what's called accommodation, your ability to focus on something up close. And so by bringing the finger in towards the nose, you can see that the person's having trouble tracking in that direction. And that comes later, and we'll do that on a regular basis.
Talked about the law that went into effect on July the 1st, 2010. Did you play a role in that law?
Yeah, me and a lot of other people, Carl Nissen at Children's Hospital, Paul Hoey at the CIAC, Fred Balsama with the Connecticut Athletic Directors, Vicki Graham at the Connecticut Athletic Trainers Association. There were a lot of people involved in writing this law from how this would become effective. I think part of the way to get something like this moving forward in the state is to get multiple partners that are affected by the law and get everybody on board beforehand.
And you said when the law was proposed, we would have been the third state, and then two other states beat us to it, so we're the fifth. But still, in a country of 50 states, that Connecticut's the fifth state that enacted this law indicates that we're kind of on the cutting edge of this. Do you anticipate the other 45 states to start making laws like this, too? Perhaps some have since we had ours enacted.
Yeah, there are 28 states as of last fall, and they keep adding to it. Massachusetts joined after us, and there was a number of other states that have also brought on. You know, one of the things that we've looked forward to in the state of Connecticut is this being proactive and helping the health and safety of the children of the state of Connecticut. And the CIAC has been really on the forefront of that, and that's with the heat and hydration. Also, there's a number of states that have moved towards, like Texas and Florida, that have moved towards this preventing heat and heat injuries in football by bringing people stepwise forward with their exposure to heat in equipment. And that's one of the things that we're moving forward to in the state of Connecticut as well.
That's really come to pass or come to light recently, especially with spring or actually summertime football camps, college and even pro camps. In fact, there was a pretty famous case involving an NFL player.
Yeah, the Corey Stringer incident in Minnesota. And since then, good things have actually come forward off of a tragedy like that. And Doug Casa does a lot of great work at the University of Connecticut, and He's been a big proponent of safety issues for heat and hydration, and they've set up guidelines through the NATA, the National Athletic Trainers Association, in preventing these type of injuries, and they have guidelines which a number of states have adopted, and looks like the CIAC is going to be adopting them upcoming this week.
What's your rule of thumb as far as hydration, especially when you're talking about exertion in hot and especially humid conditions?
Yeah, a good general guideline is 16 ounces per hour and then 16 ounces beforehand. You know, as you exercise, some people are big sweaters. They sweat a lot more than other people, and one of those type of people need to bump up their water outtake. One of the things to keep in mind, if you're out exercising in heat and you notice the white residue starts to form on your shirt, you're losing a fair amount of salt, and then anytime you're exercising more than an hour, you should add some salt onto your fluids.
And again, it comes back, I think, largely, not exclusively, to football, because frequently in those summertime practices before the season begins, they're wearing pads and equipment, so you've got heat, you've got humidity, and you're not exactly wearing shorts and a T-shirt some of the time.
No, and most of the problems that we have are really with the equipment sports. Sports like soccer and shorts and a T-shirt, you're protected a lot more. As well, in football, with the helmet and the pads, you can't radiate that heat. So the heat that you build up from exercise can't get out of your body because of the pads. They act as insulation. It's very helpful when you're playing football in November, but it's not very helpful when you're playing football in August. And that's where the law starts off, where the athletes are in shorts and T-shirts, and then they move to helmets and shoulder pads, and then they move to full equipment.
This law about concussions came into effect on July 1st, 2010, and many times a law winds up being a compromise. I wonder if you, as a doctor who deals with these type of concussions, would you like to see it go even further?
I'd like to see it go down to youth sports. I think it'd be important for the youth of the state of Connecticut to be protected as well. There's a lot of youth soccer and youth football, where kids get hit in the head, and coaches, they don't know. You know, they don't want the kids to get hurt, but they also want to teach them how to be deal with adversity and move forward. And one of the things that you don't want to necessarily deal with adversity is head injuries. It's one thing to get a bruise on the leg or get kicked in the shin or, you know, those type of problems versus a head injury, which is a lot more severe.
One of the main provisions of the Connecticut law, all coaches holding a coaching permit issued by the State Board of Education are required to take a 3-hour concussion training course. So that essentially means anybody coaching high school sports, I guess, has to take that. So what types of things are they learning besides the simple stuff of how to diagnose a concussion in that 3-hour session?
Yeah. So the 3-hour session was part of the compromise because they're divided into 3-hour sessions, these teaching. And they learn a lot more than probably coaches need to know. Those things involve the basics of the science and of how concussions occur and how injuries occur, and then how to identify concussions, and then how concussions are treated by physicians. And those things are part of the whole big package. Then there's a refresher annually, which is more narrow focus down and done by the athletic directors. So I think, you know, if you were to look at what could a coach get away with and be still helpful for the state, probably we need to look at moving it down to an hour and then add other things in those 3-hour segments, such as first aid, and other things like that.
You mentioned the annual review, and my notes here say annually coaches are expected to review new information provided by the State Board of Education. So it's been 2.5 years since the law came into effect. Is there a lot of new information about concussions, or is it what we already knew back in 2010?
Sure. Not much new information for us right now with concussions. There's an international meeting which occurs every couple of years, and it just finished up. And again, it was at Zurich. I think they just schedule those so they can make travel arrangements.
How many times you see conferences like in Bangor, Maine. Generally, it's, you know, in Tampa or...
Exactly.
In the wintertime, too, by the way.
Exactly.
Yeah, they know what they're doing.
And so they're going to come back with new recommendations. Part of the guidelines is really looking at rehab, as we talked about. We don't know, other than rest, we know that rest works. But it's hard to tell people, look, just rest, you'll get better. They like to have some intervention, something that helps them. And so that's part of the, hopefully part of the new guidelines, some of the newer research. One of the other things that we've seen coming out of Buffalo, John Letty out of Buffalo, has noted that there's an exercise component after a number of weeks that you can do, and finding that level of exercise that somebody can do without making themselves worse actually speeds up recovery. And he did a lot of work with Sidney Crosby in Pittsburgh after he had gotten his concussion and had been out for such a long time, and they figured out the amount of exercise he could do to help move him forward.
All right, full disclosure, Dr. Tom, in your younger days, I assume, did you ever have a concussion?
Yeah, I didn't have a concussion until I was older, my concussion came about from playing recreational volleyball when someone decided it was advantageous to kick the ball, which I never learned when I played volleyball.
Can you do that? Is it? Like,
yeah, I don't think they were supposed to do that, but
we got kicked. Well, if it doesn't hit the ground, it's okay, right?
Yeah. So we got so I got kicked in the head. That was my one concussion.
All right, so how did they treat that then, and if it were now, would they treat it differently?
Yeah, so the treatment then really was, if you weren't that bad, if you had what's called a bell ringer, a lot of people would have these little, so to speak, concussions where they'd get a little dizziness, a little blurred vision, and then they'd shake it off and then wait a few minutes and go back and play, or not even. That's not treated that way anymore. It's treated to let the person rest, give them 24 hours of symptom-free, and then start to move them forward.
Now, when you got yours, did you know right away you had one?
No, I didn't know. I didn't feel right. It was I was actually with other doctors, and they were like, you have a concussion.
Did they do the index finger thing?
They did. They did do the index finger thing, and they also made fun of me later, so it was appropriate.
Did you deal with it okay? Was it?
Yeah, we did
have
fine.
Have you gotten over it, I mean?
I have.
All
we
that
rested.
Needling by the doctors?
We did.
But that, on a more serious note, once in a while I try to get serious, but on a more serious note, has the fact that you have actually had a concussion give you more compassion or more understanding of what the student-athletes that you're dealing with have?
I don't think me having a concussion gave me more compassion, because I see the kids have the symptoms and signs that don't resolve. So those kids who got a concussion and then got another concussion without being treated appropriately, and you see the devastation to their lives, the fact that they can't go to school, the fact that they have trouble studying, they fall behind, they can't participate in sports, and you can see the pain that they're having. And that's the big problem for me, is that discomfort, that pain that they're having from not being able to participate in athletics. And if we can stop that, if we can prevent that overlapping concussion syndrome, or we can start the healing sooner for them, I think we'd be at an advantage.
Yeah, it seems to me that if you're more proactive, which this 2010 law makes coaches and schools be more proactive, there's a better chance that the student-athlete will get back on the field, and maybe more importantly, certainly more importantly, back in the classroom, being alert in the classroom faster.
Yeah, you hope so. And I think that we don't have the injury surveillance system that we need in the state of Connecticut to know that when we do laws like this, that things are doing well. You know, we've looked at Yale has a way of tracking concussions, because they've been interested in concussions for a while. And when we looked at Yale's data on the number of high school 14 to 18-year-olds with concussions, we saw that once the law was passed, there's actually more kids going to the emergency department now for concussions than prior to the law. And I think that that means that more kids are being recognized as having concussions, and we can start part of the healing sooner. I think that's one of the advantages of the law. The problem is it's one location. We don't know what's going on in the rest of the state, and concussions is a big problem, but there's a lot of other problems too.
And we're joined today by Dr. Tom Trojan, Director of the Injury Prevention and Sports Outreach Programs at the New England Musculoskeletal Institute at the UConn Health Center. Maybe a little side trip here. Tell me, what is the Injury Prevention and Sports Outreach Program at the New England Musculoskeletal Institute? It's a mouth. Is that all fit on one business card?
Yeah, believe it or not, it does.
What is it all about?
Sure. So we do a number of things. One is work with the CIAC as a sports medicine advisor. We work with the Connecticut Concussion Task Force, a number of other groups, and we work it to try to prevent injuries in the state of Connecticut. And we'll go out and speak to different Pop Warner football, different youth groups, and we're always available, myself, to speak to groups about concussions, about injury prevention. We, as you're aware from our previous talks about ACL, and we do a lot of ACL prevention work, and are willing to go out and speak to groups on a regular basis. So if people you know, would like to have somebody come out and talk to their coaches about injury prevention and injury prevention outreach, things like that, and how to stop ACL injuries, how to stop concussions, we'll be happy to speak with them. And they can just go to our New England Musculoskeletal Institute website, which is nemsi.uchc.edu. So.
And you can also contact me because I know how to get in touch with this guy. Yeah, we've done a couple of shows before regarding injuries, particularly to high school athletes when it comes to soccer and things like that. So this is not the first time that Dr. Tom has been in our studio today. But the primary topic today does have to do with preventing concussions and the like. You referred to the injury surveillance system in high school athletics. It's probably the whole umbrella of what we talked about today, but specifically, what is the injury surveillance system?
Sure. So we're starting to push towards getting an injury surveillance system in the high schools in the state of Connecticut. We don't have a way to determine how these rules change and affect people, and where do we need to focus our next injury prevention. And so in order to do that, we need some type of surveillance system. And you know, Representative Susan Johnson was nice enough to bring this up in the Public Health Committee at the state and move this forward. We'd like to get 20 schools to start with and move forward from there. We have interest from the different groups. Carl Nissen at Children's Hospital was instrumental in moving this forward as well. We're working with Paul Hoey at the CIAC and, once again, Vicki Graham in the Connecticut Athletic Trainers Association, trying to find different schools throughout the state that have the ability for us to start a surveillance system and move these things forward. The UConn Foundation has donated some money to us to move this forward, and it's starting to snowball, and I think it's very exciting and very useful. One of the things that we don't know is when we move to the playoff system for football, we're now having football games on Tuesday and Saturday, and the concern is when you have a football game on Saturday, Thursday for Thanksgiving, which is the traditional game, then the following Tuesday and the following Saturday, does the number of injuries increase? And we'd like to track that and be able to follow that out. And that's part of this injury surveillance system, as well as, you know, our concussions keeping people out for prolonged periods of time.
So the surveillance system actually goes beyond just the concussion thing that we're focusing on this morning.
Right. It's all injuries. And they have been done in Ohio and a number of other states, and it's one of those things where we don't need every single school, but we need a representation of the schools so that we can make sure that we're doing the right by the kids, and we want to make sure that the children in the state of Connecticut are safe. And I think the CIAC really has been moving towards protecting the kids of the state of Connecticut and allow the children to participate safely in athletics.
I think you're right, too, about the playoff system. Of course, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. They're on basically a game-every-week schedule, and then, as you said, you wind up some teams playing as many as three games in a week and a half. But the other side of the coin is, do you want to keep playing into, you know, December when it's colder and there's snow and things like that? You kind of like to get it wrapped up.
Right, exactly. And you also run into before you'd have four teams from each division only making the playoffs. And by moving to eight, you doubled the number of teams and also the excitement for the high school. And if you've been to the high school playoffs before, the number of parents that are coming out, the whole school spirit, it's really exciting. And, you know, I get the pleasure of covering some of them on the sidelines, and it's been exciting to watch.
Speaking to parents, I'm glad you brought that up, because we've talked so much about whose responsibility it is to spot these concussions. It kind of comes back to the coaches of these various sports. But I would think, since this new law in Connecticut became effective on July 1st, 2010, you must have gotten some positive feedback from parents throughout the state, because they feel now that their son or their daughter is being taken care of better, or they are safer than they were before this rule went into effect.
We do get positive feedback from parents. Parents are very excited about this. There was some concern by coaches that this might be a problem, but afterwards we found that coaches, once they had the law implemented, felt it was a great addition as well. So between the parents, the ADs, and the coaches, we've gotten a lot of positive feedback from PA 1062.
We had talked earlier about the annual review, especially reviewing new information, but there's also a part of the law that says every 5 years after the initial training, coaches must complete a refresher course. How does that differ from the annual review?
Sure. So all of the three-hour units have to be redone. They only last for 5 years, and so they have to be redone again. If the intent of that was that you don't just take the concussion one once, because there's going to be new ideas and new thoughts on concussions. And so you'll retake that unit again, because those module, those three-hour modules that they have to take will be renewable every 5 years.
Is there ever going to be a case, or has there been a case, when a student athlete who exhibits signs or symptoms of a concussion is allowed to come back in and play in the game when he or she was injured?
We haven't had any reports of that, and that is a reportable problem. If that were to happen and parents know of that, they can move that forward. The CIAC gets a lot of self-reports. The whole institute is driven by self-reports, and everybody is very diligent in reporting violations. Some people ask, like, why would you report it? It's because it's part of the whole trust in being part of the CIAC that schools self-report, and we haven't had that reported to us, which is a good thing, because you see the things that do get reported, it's promising to know that the concussions then isn't happening, that kids aren't returned to play without being pulled.
Coaching permits may be revoked if coaches are in violation of these provisions. In the 2.5 years the law has been in place, has that come to fruition? Have you had any coaches that have lost their permits?
No, we haven't, because the coaches are abiding by it. When you work with the coaches, they find this makes their job easier, that they don't have to make that decision. They don't have to decide, should this kid play or should they not play? They have signs and symptoms of concussions. They learn what those are, and they just pull the kid, and they realize that, you know, that it's for the safety and it's for the health of the children.
And it sounds like what you've said and the people you've identified this morning, that in general the CIAC is promoting safety in high school athletics, not just when it comes to concussions.
Right, and with the heat and hydration rules and with the other safety issues that are coming up, they'd like to promote safety and health issues. And they continue to do these issues, whether it's lightning safety, we have policies on that, we have policies on heat and hydration. There's a lot of different issues that aren't always favorable. The lightning one often comes up to prevent lightning strikes, which you may have seen a number of high school football players have gotten hit throughout the country because they go back. They don't respect the fact that you don't have to be right underneath a cloud in order to get hit by lightning.
Not just football. Happens in golf.
Yeah.
People elsewhere besides just on athletic fields get hit by lightning as well. I wonder, when it comes to these training sessions that coaches must have, does that mean just a head coach? Would that mean an assistant coach as well?
Anybody who has a coaching license gets this education.
Okay.
And as we talked about before, the head coach isn't always watching the whole field, and it's important that the position coaches, the offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator, has that opportunity to identify their athletes that may not be acting in their normal aspect. It's important for the coaches because they get to know the kids. They get to know how the kids normally act.
And hopefully it works out in the long run for the better for the student athlete, and they can avoid any kind of long-term issues. What about the issue of multiple concussions? A student athlete had a concussion a month ago. They've now been cleared to play by medical professionals, and they get another one. Talk about the effect of multiple concussions, because now you're talking a real danger zone.
You are, and when you look at the data, you know, we have a limited ability to look at human beings and look at how their brains affected from multiple hits until after they pass away. But what we do see is we have models in animals, and they do multiple concussions on animals. And if an animal gets a concussion and it's not healed, their brain hasn't gone back to normal, and they get another concussion, then they're running into problems. They get actual death of the neurons. But if they heal and return back to normal and get another concussion, that will heal as well. You don't get those same neuronal deaths. One of the things that we talk about with football and whether or not chronic traumatic encephalopathy is a problem in football players is the fact that we don't know that people had concussions when returned. These aren't people who had concussions. Let them resolve. Let them get better before they return to sports. And I think that's the big problem, is making sure that the person is back to normal before returning them to sports.
You know, we've talked football, we've talked soccer, we even had a little venture into volleyball for a second, too. But I would think hockey would be on the list, too, as far as sports where concussions are more possible.
It is. It's very much in both male and female hockey. One of the things in men's hockey is it's a collision sport. You know, you have checking. In women's ice hockey, you don't have checking. But you still, it's a contact sport, and when you're playing women's ice hockey and you're not expecting somebody to collide into you, you're not braced, and that's part of the problem that people have is that unexpected hit and getting hit and not having their shoulders braced, their neck muscles strong in order to protect that head from moving.
And I don't see as many concussions in basketball. I see them once in a while. But it seems to me when I see a concussion, it isn't so much a head-to-head thing going for a rebound. Maybe that does happen. But I've seen several cases, including one this year, where a player falls down, the head snaps back, head hits the floor, and therefore a concussion might occur.
Yeah, you don't have to get hit in the head in order to get a concussion. I've seen cases where people get hit in the body. You know, and people also will get concussions in automobile accidents without their head necessarily hitting. It's because their body is moving and it stops and the head keeps moving. So you get this whiplash where the brain inside the head keeps moving and hits the skull.
Got a couple minutes left here, Tom. I want you to tell the listeners about climbing Mount Washington in the wintertime.
Yeah, so that was an exciting. We were talking about the fact that you've been up on the top of the mountain and you've climbed in the summer. And in the winter, it's very exciting. Besides it being extremely cold, the wind is whipping, and it's otherworldly. And being able to get up and climb and having to use your crampons and dig into the snow and move up. And it's a guided trip that they do through the up at Mount Washington with a number of the groups, and it's very exciting.
But you didn't quite make it to the top?
I didn't. I ran into boot problems, so we ended up with bleeding in our boot, and we had blood-soaked socks, so we decided that we'd cut our losses and for the better of go and attack it another day. So that's still a goal, so you and I need to do that.
Let's talk. Although I'd prefer it more in the summertime, Tom. You know, I mean, I have done the Grand Canyon, but I've not really gone bottom to top in Mount Washington. I've done some hiking around the top, down to Lake of the Clouds and things like that. But I would think, how close did you come?
Oh, very close. Right at the top there.
6,000 feet or something?
Yeah. So,
wow, the mountain's 6,288.
Yeah.
I'm impressed.
We were very close, but sometimes you have to say enough's enough.
Tom Trojan, our guest this morning. Tom, letting people know about this rule, this law that's been in effect since 2010 to try to reduce the impact of concussions on high school athletes in the state. Tom is director of the Injury Prevention and Sports Outreach Programs at the New England Musculoskeletal Institute at the UConn Health Center. Good information, Tom. Thanks for coming in this morning.
Thank you.